from the spread of the infection. Stay the course, BT asked. We weren't committed. Not yet. But pain was out there, and it would be foolish to believe she wasn't planning on striking soon. That she had let down her guard enough that we could see her made that painfully obvious. I wondered if she'd known about this 100-mile pileup. I don't see any reason not to. I said the words, but in my heart I wondered if perhaps we were heading into Payne's trap and not the other way around. I'll always wonder if I should have spoken up, should have said something. Would they have listened, or would I have been vetoed? We were tired of running, and Payne needed to be dealt with. This was our chance to be rid of her, to finally put the worst of this damned war behind us. Even I wasn't naive enough to believe that would be the ultimate outcome, but hope has a way of spreading its flowery tendrils over the nastiest of situations, even if it is mostly for ornamentation. We were 5 miles from the Arch Cape Tunnel, according to the signs. I wasn't thrilled that most of these were riddled with bullet holes. I don't really have a problem with a street sign being shot. It happens. Idiots, for some reason, get a kick out of it. Not my particular flavor of Kool-Aid, but whatever. Just that with zombies everywhere, why would you unnecessarily do anything to attract them? By now we were traveling at a blistering 20 miles per hour, picking our way through the thickening traffic. Even the breakdown lanes were becoming more congested, as those that had fled had desperately driven the shoulders and even farther off the road where possible. Have you ever found yourself on a juice diet sometime in your life, for whatever reason? Maybe shed a few pounds before a big day, or just trying to eat a little more healthy? A nice raspberry smoothie in place of an oh-so-delicious quarter pounder with cheese and an extra-large fry. So you grab the blender that hasn't been used for anything but margaritas since you got it, no matter what you told yourself the reasons for buying it were. Now, finally, it will serve that purpose. So you cut up some bananas, toss in a basket of fresh strawberries and raspberries, along with a helping of milk and some ice cubes. If you're going to have a liquid lunch, you're going to make it as close to a milkshake as humanly possible. You blend that thing into a thick, rich smoothie frappe. Pour it into a nice tall glass. Then you lament when you look back at the blender and the amount of cleanup it is going to require. The sides are coated in congealing clumps of red, unidentifiable bits of brown and black stand out among the debris, and this is all coated with a thick white layer, which, if left alone for too long, will mold a sickly greenish color. Right now, you're staring at this journal, wondering, where in the hell is this man going with this? Smack dab in the middle of a zombie invasion, and this idiot is talking about shakes. Stay with me, I'm about to get there. You see, the insides of a lot of the cars we were passing looked like a lot of those healthy frappes. Like, instead of a gear shift, the car had a huge twirling blade inside of it, and it made a puree out of everything living or dead in that vehicle. Though the black or brown strawberry seeds were more likely eyeballs or pieces of liver and intestines. I don't know what horror show happened on this highway, but these cars were fucked up. Maybe one occupant was able to get a shot off, splattering the brains of a loved one all over the interior. Or the more likely scenario, a hungry zombie with little to no table manners. Or it was even possible that the dead trapped in the cars had exploded as a result of the gases bodies released and the greenhouse effect within the car would have on those corpses. Too much information? Try driving past it. Whatever the reason, it was happening more and more, and no matter how much I tried to ignore it, avoid it, unsee it, even I could not. Every once in a while, the nightmare would get just a little more vivid. A hand would smear against the detritus, trying to clear away the gunk to watch the living pass. Once I even saw an incredibly long tongue try to lick its way through like it was tasting a corpsicle. Had to admit I was happy Gary had switched rides. I was barely holding on. I could only imagine the strangled sounds his stomach and throat would be making. Those that weren't driving were doing everything in their power to scope out their laps or check out the patterns in their skin from their clasped hands. "Can't drive any faster, Mike?" Tracy asked, never looking up as she did so. I didn't answer because I was afraid what would come out if I opened my mouth. It was a blessing when we finally got to the mouth of the tunnel. It was dark inside and made seeing the cars that much more difficult. According to BT, he had thought it had a slight bend in it, which I happily confirmed, as I could not see the light from the other side. This would work to our advantage. The jam was as thick as it could get. The only slice of luck that we'd had was that someone with a plow had done his best to slam his way through. Cars had been pushed over and onto each other as he or she tried to get past. Like a slow-moving needle, we threaded through the narrow opening afforded us. We weren't more than 20 feet in when the temperature and the lighting plummeted. Not the first misgivings, but definitely the deepest, hit me just then. The sun was setting, and when it did, well, we all knew what that meant. The blackness was going to be absolute. The pileup of cars had finally disappeared about 3/4 of the way through the tunnel. It was clear to us all, as we looked out the far side, at what had caused it to begin with. "Military blockade," BT said. "Why would they do this?" Winters asked. "In a vain attempt to stop the spread, of course," Deneau replied. We had gotten out and were all standing there in more or less a line, looking at the opening. The pull was strong to forgo this crazy plan and make a straight line up the coast and on to Etna Station. I wanted to check the Humvees up ahead for some heavy machine guns, but fun would have to wait. Plus, that would defeat the purpose of what we were trying to accomplish. "I'm going to set the charges," Winter said as he peeled away from the group. "This looked way better on paper," BT said when we were alone. We got the kids and the animals all locked up in one of the cars as we took our places. The idea was to fake a crash. The small explosion Winters was going to set off would hopefully convince Payne that we had crashed, and when no one came out the other side, she would be forced to investigate. When she was in range, we would kill her. Just like that, quick and easy. Although now that we were here, it seemed anything but. First, a fatal crash seemed unlikely, given the traffic. What if she didn't bite? What if she waited a week, a month, before checking it out? What if the stupid tunnel collapsed from a magnitude 8 earthquake? What if it collapsed from Winter's charge? I could do the bad outcomes game all day long and still maybe never come across what was really going to go wrong. "Fire in the hole!" Winters made sure we heard it, but not loud enough that it would reach either end. This was our cue to find cover and cover our ears. Even then, I thought the resultant explosion was going to shred my eardrums. The tunnel, the ground, the cars around us vibrated from the concussive forces. A few ceiling tiles shook loose and smashed against the ground and cars. The destructive noise was even scarier than the initial explosion because we had not been expecting it. "Should we light a fire?" BT asked. I thought about it. Would certainly lend authenticity to our crash site. No, as much as I'd like to chase away the dark and the chill, it'll screw up our vision. Not to mention the obvious, Mike, but we're not going to be able to see anything anyway. Are you already forgetting about the NVGs that came with Winters? I hate those things, man. Make everything look that ghostly green shit, like we're in a horror movie. I'm not sure what pleasure cruise you've been riding, big man, but we are in a horror movie, and I, for one, don't want to be the brother that goes down the basement by himself. BT laughed. "Just what the hell is funny about any of this?" I asked in all seriousness. "Just trying to picture you with a fro is all." "I could pull it off," I said. "No, man, not at all. But it is funny." "You want the night vision goggles or what?" I asked, handing out a pair. "Nah, we only have the 3, and Winters isn't giving his up. You keep them so you can keep an eye out on Deneau," he said. It truly sucked, always having to keep one eye on a member of the group, and there had been serious debate about giving her a set of the coveted goggles. But no matter the arguments against it, it always circled back to her incredible marksmanship skills. Not a one of us could touch her. Now the problem was, would she stand and fight or tactically withdraw, as the situation dictated? It wouldn't be the first time. That was obviously the flip side. "You just tell me when to hit the flares," Winters had set up a string of flares, 5 on each side, spaced out roughly 10 feet apart. The hope was we pulled Payne in close. BT lit up the tunnel, putting her in the spotlight, and we blew her into whatever realm she belonged. We got into the best positions we could. Winters was facing the south entrance, Deneau the north, and I was constantly turning back and forth like a weather vane in a fickle wind. The dark was a cruel and crushing enemy, but a necessary ally. Not sure how the cookie crumbles on that. By increments, we lost all of our ambient lighting. By the time we switched over to the goggles, it was impossible to see your own hand. You want to know what sense picks up the slack and distorts everything incredibly? Hearing. It feels the need to make everything it senses become a monster in the dark. Maybe not quite so relevant when there were fewer monsters in the world, but right now one had to assume everything one heard was a monster. Car suspensions squeaked as zombies shifted around inside their prisons, trying to find ways out. There was the skittering of rodents and other small animals as they scavenged for food, no longer able to rely on the droppings of the most wasteful beings on the planet. Fuck them, now they had to work at it like the rest of us. Gotta imagine rats were pretty pissed off, no longer able to subsidize their existence with potato chips and corn dog crust. Bird calls entered in from either side. By the time they reached us, they'd become how I figured the prehistoric world sounded. In the dark, it was hard not to imagine them as 15-foot pterodons. There was a cacophony of noise, but no Payne. She was conspicuously absent. With the goggles on, our sight took on the alien green ghostly landscape that BT disliked. Don't get me wrong, these devices are an incredible invention, but they are not without their drawbacks. First off is that of color. The human brain is used to dealing with vivid and varied colors. When the landscape suddenly becomes that drab, eerie green, the brain, in its ever-determined desire to make sense of whatever input it receives, will resort to creating shadows and hallucinations, specters where none exist. If you are vigilant, you can overcome this flaw, but the bigger one is the complete lack of peripheral vision. And that's physical. A primary human defense is to spot threats from the side. The goggles are essentially blinders, creating the constant need to swivel your head, which is a diverting and a time-consuming venture. Anything? BT asked, for at least the 5th time in the last 10 minutes. I'd answered him civilly enough the first couple of times. Then I had to bite back on what I wanted to say. Yeah, man, they're all coming. I'm just trying to see how close they can get before I sound the alarm. I had to remember he was sitting in the complete dark, and I've got to tell you, that does something to time, or our perception of it anyway. Seconds become minutes, minutes become hours. Well, you get the picture. Nothing, man, I whispered. The tunnel had been as black as Eliza's soul for 2 hours. My eyes and my skull were beginning to fatigue from the goggles, and that was far from the worst of it. I kept looking up to the far right corner where information on what the goggles were receiving was displayed, along with the life of the batteries. I was sitting comfortably at half, but where would I be in another hour or two? 3 hours from now, when Payne was sure to show, they would be completely drained. How many of us could she kill in that complete darkness before we were even aware she was among us? I'll be right back, I said to BT. You're shitting me, right? You're really going to leave me in the dark? Just got to talk to Winters for a second. Make him come over here. I'll be right back, man. I hate you, he hissed as I started to move. Wait. Sorry. Just in case anything happens, I don't want those to be my last words. I loathe you. Yeah, that has more oomph behind it. Winters turned as he heard me approaching. How are you doing? I asked. Feel the building of an enormous headache coming on. Yeah, I think I've beaten you to that punch. How's your battery? Little under half, he replied, knowing where I was going with this. We should maybe do this in shifts, I said. I don't like that. There are too many blind spots for one person to pick up. They're all going to be blind spots if we don't. He mulled that one for a moment. Half-hour shifts, then? He asked. Sounds good. I'll take the first. Rest your eyes, he said, as he readjusted his position to be able to more easily see down the tunnel in both directions. Then I found Deneau and told her my concern as well. You sure? She could cover the distance before any one of us could scope out the entire tunnel. Not sure what choices we have. We're going to have to hope we're not that unlucky. Michael, I realize you rely heavily on luck in your life. I'm not sure how smart it is to bank everyone else's on it. If the well runs dry, there will be no one left to be concerned about it. I wasn't trying to be flippant. I was trying to ignore her words. To acknowledge them was to potentially imbue them with a potent curse or make them somehow true. Words can bring power to thoughts and ideas. One should be careful not to give negative ones any more of a hold over us than they already had. I'm coming back, I whispered to BT. I could see him doing his best to pierce the darkness with his eyes. Of course, he was not succeeding by straining, and I didn't want to receive a friendly fire punch to the head. What the hell, man? You go out for a sandwich or a show or something? I've been gone for 5 minutes. Really? He asked. He sounded and looked so sincere, I had to believe that was how he felt. What's up? He asked, knowing full well I wouldn't have left a post without having a good reason. We're running out of battery time. Shit. How long? Couple of hours at the most. Talk to Winters and Deneau. We're going to do shifts. Can't say I like how vulnerable that is going to leave us. I know, brother. Don't know what else to do. We could leave this tunnel, he replied. Thought of that. But I can feel it in my bones, BT. She is going to strike tonight. The tunnel keeps her somewhat limited to where she can come from. We won't be afforded the same advantage outside. Advantage. Fighting in the dark is somehow an advantage to you. Is there anything you won't say? Not much. And it's not the dark that's the advantage. It's the setup. Odds are she can see pretty good in this, and she thinks we won't be able to, I told him, as I shut down my goggles. BT sighed at my words. Wow, this sucks, I said. I tried to peer through the darkness with the exact results you would expect. You think? He asked sarcastically. Could occasionally hear someone moving around, the murmurings of a baby or two. Luckily, Ben was keeping his bacon-loving self quiet. Of us all, he had me the most worried. That thought released some hold I'd kept on my claustrophobia. Suddenly, I was doing my best to mentally push against the walls of the tunnel. They had begun to constrict around us. The more I struggled to keep control of the space around me, the harder my heart thumped. It was getting to the point where each beat physically hurt. I was just reaching up to turn the goggles back on when I heard the scrape of metal on metal. What was that? BT asked. Shh, I said quietly. I powered up my goggles and waited an interminable amount of time while they booted up. Couldn't have been more than 15 seconds. Seemed like a fucking eon. And in that time frame, I heard two more pops and squeals. Then I recognized the sound. It was car doors being opened, and too far away to be our people doing it. That what I think it is? BT asked. What do you think it is? I asked. Car doors opening. Yeah, that's what I thought, too. How are the zombies opening their doors just now after all the time they've been trapped? Oh, I don't think it's zombies opening the doors, I said when I caught a black flash of something moving quickly through the vehicles. I hate her. Nice to see that anger directed at someone else besides me. Don't worry, BT said. I have enough to go around. Crap, I said, as I peered through the goggles. What is it, Mike? You usually don't give two shits when I utter my dislike for you. She's opened the zoo, man. Zombies are coming. Contact, Winter said from his side. Zombies, couple dozen. Same, I told him. She's gonna know we're playing possum the moment we start firing on those zombies, Mike. She's testing us, BT said. Winters, pull back to me. Get everyone in with you, I said. I reached around and tapped those nearby and guided them to my spot. Pain is here, I told them, She's letting loose the zombies to see if we will betray our location and plan. Right now, we have to hope it's because she doesn't know if we're alive or not. Yeah, but Dad, there are zombies coming and none of us can see anything. This from Travis. He was putting on a brave face, but there was a noticeable tremor in his voice. Could not fault him for that. Being in a battle was stressful enough. Being in a battle where you couldn't see your enemy? Far, far worse. How close are you planning on letting them get? Tracy asked. Too fucking close, I told her. I don't like what that implies, Mike. What the exact fuck does that mean? BT asked, looking for clarification. I don't know. I don't know. Payne is going to want to confirm our deaths. That I know. The question is, will she wait until the zombies finish eating us to come and take a gander? That's too close, BT said. Yeah, I'm getting that. I'm just hoping Payne brings her happy ass in with the Z's. And if she doesn't, Tracy asked. Then we kill the zombies and get the hell out of here. She won't fall for another trap, my wife said. Doesn't really seem like she fell for this one, BT said. Not so sure about that. She's here, isn't she? I replied. Yeah, with her own army, BT replied. 25 yards. Winters was keeping an eye on the northern side of the tunnel. 50 yards. I was doing my best to judge the distance. Depth perception was difficult at best with the goggles. Any sign of pain? Tommy asked. No, I said, tight-lipped. I had another shitty idea, and I was wondering if I should play it. I think we should go out to meet her. You can't do that. How will you get by the zombies? Tracy asked. We stay up against the wall. There are no zombies there, I said. Who would go? BT asked. Tommy and myself. So you're going to leave us all alone back here, with one set of NVGs and zombies coming in from both sides? You realize we'll be firing straight past you. I mean, hopefully, and not into you. We'll stay pinned to the wall while we can. But this is a chance we have to take. She's close. We have to strike while we can. Maybe it would be best if all of you got back in the cars. Winters, do we have enough time for you to get them all back in a car? Just. All right, let's do this then. Dunno, I need the goggles. She handed them over reluctantly. You ready, Tommy? I'd rather be eating a Pop-Tart, he replied. I've seen some of the flavors you dig up. This is safer. If you say so, but that eggplant-filled hollandaise sauce-glazed one was out of this world. If you say so, I said, repeating his words. No matter how slowly and cautiously the group moved to get into the cars, I could still hear the groan of metal as the doors were being opened. I could only hope that the sound of the moaning and shuffling zombies was sufficiently loud enough to drown it out. My back was getting damp from the wet, weeping through the cracks in the concrete wall. I'm sure it didn't help that I was sweating from the stress of what we were attempting to do. Tommy was leading the way, moving a lot quicker than I was comfortable with. The zombies, for the most part, were like thrown arrows, meaning they were only going in the direction Payne threw them, or in this case, shown. Though now and again, some would turn our way as we approached, like a particularly delicious-smelling hamburger being paraded around a bunch of poor college students. Tommy put his hand up and hit me in the shoulder, halting my progress. He pointed to a place up ahead of us. Zombies were coming straight our way, being funneled by a camper that had collided with a small pickup. Our only option was to get up on the SUV in front of us. Once atop it, we would be like dual surfers above a sea of shit, which just barely beats being dual swimmers in the sea of shit. The hood pinged loudly as I jumped onto it, but that had nothing on the sound the roof made as Tommy climbed up. Sounded like a Tibetan monk smacking the hell out of a gong. If anything was ever going to scream dinner to the Z's, that was it. As I looked up at Tommy to see what the hell he could have done to make that kind of noise, I swear I saw Payne move quickly past in the shadows behind him. No doubt she'd heard it as well. Could only hope she thought it was a minivan banging into the back of a band bus. Tommy reached over and helped me up. The zombies were indeed curious about what was causing all the racket. I felt a hand smack up against my calf. Jagged fingernails sought purchase in the thick leather of my boots. I stood up to keep less of me in reach. It worked in that respect, but with so many zombies crowding around, they were making the car rock. I was only using the surfing bit as an analogy. I didn't think it was going to come true. I can smell your fear. Payne's voice drifted over to us like an ill wind. Tommy tapped me on the shoulder and pointed. I didn't see much of anything, though he was emphatic. I cannot believe you would make it quite this easy for me. With the zombies and the acoustics of the tunnel, it was difficult for me to locate her. Tommy had brought his rifle to his shoulder. You have a better angle, he whispered. I wanted to tell him, better angle at what? But it was all I could do to keep my feet under me as the zombies pitched our boat around like orcas tossing a seal. Keep me steady, I told him as I brought my rifle up. He lowered his weapon and did as I asked. Safe to assume she knows we're here. I'd say so, he answered. With my forward right hand, I pushed a button that illuminated my green laser. It cut through the fog and unsettled dust, and just for the tiniest of moments, it illuminated silver off the eye of what I figured was Payne. I didn't even bother waiting for a return message from my brain to confirm what I had seen. I pulled the trigger the exact moment the green twinkled silver. The resultant flare from my muzzle temporarily blinded me to the result of the bullet I sent outwards. I didn't see a prone body or a blood spray on the far wall. No scream nor wail. There was nothing to give me any hint of success or failure. Well, there was a fair measure of failure, as I had completely blown our cover. Zombies that had passed us by were coming back. That was good for our loved ones. Bad for us. The camper! Tommy shouted as zombies began to press in from all around. Sounds like a wonderful idea. It's just that the camper's 10 feet away, I told him. He backed up as far as the roof of the SUV would allow, took 2 running steps and leaped. His trailing foot caught a zombie flush in the face, busting out a row of teeth, but it didn't slow him down as he crash-landed into the camper ladder. He quickly climbed up and onto the much higher roof. Now you, Mr. T! He had got down onto his stomach and had his arms outstretched. My jump, in comparison to Tommy's near-graceful one, was a comedy of errors. I backed up like he did, and that's where all similarities stopped. Instead of 2 steps, I went for 3, giving the zombies around me just enough time to grab at the bottom of my pants. 1 succeeded. It was not a momentum-stopping grab, and it surely cost him most of the fingernails on his right hand, but it was just enough to make my flight for life come up a tad short. I was in the air, knowing full well I was not going to make it. Didn't keep me from stretching my arms out in a desperate attempt to fly to that chrome-plated ladder. So when my fingers grazed against the middle rungs, I almost wanted to cry out in disbelief at my good fortune. I was finally able to grab hold of the 2nd rung from the bottom. I pulled my body over the closest zombies and started scrambling up. That's when I heard pop, pop, pop in quick succession. Noises everywhere. Didn't think too much of it until the ladder began yawing backward. It was pulling free of its moorings. My guess is it wasn't designed to withstand the stresses of 2 full-grown men jumping from distance onto it. I don't know why I always forget about Tommy's inhuman strength. He reached out and grabbed the ladder before I could spill back into the throng. He stood and lifted the thing with me on it straight up into the air, even going so far as to let a zombie hitch a ride for part of the way. I kicked out repeatedly with my left foot until the monster's face was a disfigured, bleeding mess of broken bone and damaged flesh. I'd crushed the right side of his face sufficiently enough that his eyeball was dislodged and hanging loose. His nose was not just lying flat, but was now embedded in his face. My boot had completely ripped his top lip off, and still the thing hung in there. I figure that's what happens when you've been living on a diet rich in floor fries from a car you could not escape. If you had a meal this close, you'd be reluctant to let go as well. Tommy reached out and grabbed me while simultaneously dropping the ladder. It, along with the zombie I had chewed up with my boot, fell back into the crowd. Did you get her? I asked. No idea. I feel like I had to have hit her, but I have no way of knowing for sure. The camper began to rock as the zombies started closing in on it. The back and forth was not as pronounced as it had been on the SUV, but it would only take one wrong placement of a foot or leaning the wrong way to send either of us over the edge. Four shots rang out from the direction we had come from, but no screams, which I took as a good sign. Unless the gunman had been silenced, that would be a bad sign. While I was looking back to the cars, Tommy had got down and was looking at the vent cover atop the camper. He'd ripped it clear from its hinges. It had not gone quietly into the night. It had protested loudly, with a heavy cracking sound as he shattered the plastic cover and frame. "No zombies inside," he said, after removing his head from the opening. "You want to go through there? Will we even fit? If this engine starts, we can drive it back, grab everyone, and get out of here." "What about Payne?" I asked. "If she's dead, we're rid of her. If she's not, she'll find us." "What the hell, Tommy? That's like telling your kid, yep, the monster's under your bed, might be dead, or it might eat your face. We'll see come morning." "Should we at least wait until tomorrow, first light? Maybe we can find a body or something?" "I suppose we could ask the zombies to move away so we could check," he said. "If she's out there, she's going to be angry. I say we don't give her enough time to regroup and strike while we're separated." I couldn't argue with that. "You should go in first," I said. "It's because you're afraid of getting stuck, isn't it?" he asked. I could only shrug in answer. I don't tend to keep my anxieties secret. He wriggled a little bit, but otherwise got in easily enough. I dropped in after him. I was not a fan of the dozen zombies peering in at us from the front of the camper. Although, creepy as it was, odds were they could not see us. "Will it start?" I asked. Tommy hadn't made it to the front console yet. He turned to look back, his expression asking if I was serious. "We're about to find out. You might want to take the goggles off." The seat cushion let out a squelch of air. I heard the jingle of keys, then the wonderful telltale dinging of a battery that still had some juice left. There was a moment where I heard nothing else. Then there was the grinding of the starter as it fired off and got the engine running. The headlights were muted, but only because the zombies were crowding the light out. I peered around, trying to catch any trace of pain. I saw nothing but more zombies. When I was confident as I could be that pain was no longer in the building, I got up beside Tommy, not yet comfortable enough to sit in the passenger seat. I had my rifle ready and cracked the passenger side window, but I was also prepared to shoot through the windshield if the need arose. We were moving at a pace slow enough that we were pushing the zombies ahead of us out of the way. Every once in a while, one didn't get the memo not to play in the street, and we would subsequently run over it with a resounding, crunchy squish. But for the most part, we were like an ice-busting barge in the Arctic, clearing a path. "How's the gas?" 3/4 of a tank. Took us close to 15 minutes to get back to our cars. "Everyone all right?" I asked through the window. BT gave a thumbs up. "Payne?" he asked. "Got a shot off, but I don't know. She wouldn't tell me if she was dead or not. Just like a vampire to be a cryptic bitch. Tommy's going to clear a path for us out with this behemoth. You all just stay in tight behind us," I said. We had to use the camper as a battering ram to get through the military blockade. It had been my hope we'd be able to confiscate the much larger and more comfortable vehicle for our own purposes. But Tommy had done some front-end damage. We were leaking coolant, and from the sound of it, the fan blade was smacking up against the radiator, or possibly the engine block. Either way, it was badly damaged, though it had served its purpose well enough. He got it up to 20 miles per hour for a couple of miles. It sounded like an infant with a wooden spoon beating on a variety of pots and pans from the cupboard. By the time he stopped, we had a geyser issuing forth from the front end. But we'd put distance between us and the zombies. The roadway was clear, and there was no sign of pain. I can't say I thought she was dead, but it sure was a beautiful day, and I wanted to believe that. "What now, Mike?" Tracy asked. I looked over each and every one of us still standing. Even the indefatigable Deneau looked done. We were so far past being on our last legs, we were writhing around on the ground. I could not, and I would not, delay it any longer. Etna Station was our destination. History can judge if I'd made a mistake, but I was certain of my decision at the time. It cannot fault me for my actions, as I looked upon my kids, my wife, my friends and family. They were scared, tired, and I would not watch another of them die in this fucking apocalypse. I was drawing a line in the sand. Sure, it was going to be crossed many times before this was over, but right there and then, the symbolism of that drawn line gave me hope and purpose. Not sure what type of technology they had at Etna, but we were 20 miles south of our destination when we found ourselves staring down the barrels of a very well-coordinated ambush. "Do not fire upon us," came through a megaphone. "These are 50-cal cannons. You will all be dead before the repercussion of your first round is finished. All of you that can, step out of your vehicles, hands held high, no weapons of any sort." BT looked over at me from the car he was in. "Your call," he said. "We're coming out," I yelled, placing my empty hands out the window first. "Don't shoot, we're coming out." I was the first to stand outside the car, and was immediately followed by the rest. They had us all sitting on the curb with our hands zip-tied behind our backs, except for the babies, and they let Nicole loose so she could care for them. Henry had to stay in the car because he was not digging how I was being treated. I appreciated the hell out of that. I did. But I didn't want a soldier inadvertently hurting my dog because of his loyalty. "My name is Gunnery Sergeant Tajima. I am part of the intercept group for Etna Station. Heard of it?" "We have," I said. "And what's your reason for coming here?" he asked. I figured this wasn't the time to tell him it was to take over the base and become lord of all I surveyed. "Sanctuary. We've been on our own for so long, we just want to have some sense of normalcy. A place where our kids have a chance." "What's your name?" he asked. "Michael Talbot." "You're the leader here." "More of an honorary thing," I replied. "You're married?" he asked, picking up my tone quickly. I nodded. "I can't guarantee that you'll get to stay. There's a vetting process, and even if you pass that, we're not a big enough facility to open up to everyone that's left. We need people with skills, engineers, doctors, teachers." "You might as well cut us loose then, Gunnery Sergeant. Save everyone the trouble," I sighed. "Michael, perhaps you should tell the man about your other talents before you discount us all so quickly," Deneau said. "What are you doing?" I fairly hissed, afraid of what the crone was about to reveal. "Michael is," she started. "Deneau," I shouted, "a former Marine with more combat under his belt than I am willing to bet any of the men under your command, Gunnery Sergeant. Of course it is imperative to welcome the intellectuals in, but is it also not important that those very same people are protected?" "What are you doing, Deneau?" I asked. "Do you want in, Michael, or do you not? It would appear that they do not have much need for pothole repairmen." She was right. She was absolutely right. But if my hands were free, I think I would have shot her and her smug, self-important self. Well, maybe not shot. Throat punched would be much more satisfying. "How many of you can fight?" he asked. Except for the babies, every one of us nodded that we could, including Deneau, which surprised the hell out of me, as I figured she was going to try and pull the senator card. She probably still would once they brought us to the base, or in case the gunnery sergeant wasn't looking for any new, old recruits. "Most of you don't look like my traditional troops, but the woman is right. We always need more soldiers," Tajima said. My head bowed of its own volition. I had brought my family here with the hopes that we could be done fighting. Turned out that was their resident criteria. The master sergeant must have seen my resignation. "It's not like that, Talbot. If you're allowed to stay, only a few of you would need to join up. The rest would be allowed to pursue some other useful field, like those aforementioned ones." "He doesn't do well with authority," BT said. "Yeah, you're one to talk," I said to him. "Only your authority," he responded. "Let's go," Tajima said. "Even if it all goes bad, worst-case scenario, we cut you loose and you'll get a meal and some new clothes out of this." "And our weapons?" I asked. "You'll get those back." They placed us all into the back of a large troop transport truck. The ride was uncomfortable, compounded by the fact that our hands were restrained behind us. Safe to say that BT, Tommy, and myself could have worked our way out of the zip ties easily enough. But we didn't. That didn't stop Deneau, though. "Treating me like a common criminal," she said, as she brought her hands to the front and rubbed her wrists. "Yeah, there's nothing common about your criminal activities," I told her. I smiled, but she sneered at me. We were separated from the rest of the camp and brought into a holding area where, true to his word, we were given a hot meal, a place to clean up, and some new clothes. Had been there for about 3 days, sleeping on cots without much contact from them, before the interviews began. Thought for sure I'd be one of the first to get questioned. Ended up being the last. I was brought to the main building, up 2 flights of ornate steps, down a hallway, and finally to a large, oak-paneled office. "Ah, Lieutenant Talbot. A pleasure to meet you. I'm Colonel Bennington." A grizzled, gray-haired man in full uniform rolled out from behind his desk. He maneuvered his wheelchair so he could shake my hand. "Lieutenant, I think you have me confused with someone else," I told him. "No, I do not. I very rarely get confused. I pulled your service records. Seems you've had some trouble, both in the civilian and military worlds, but your tour of duty was exemplary. Your group speaks most highly of you, to a person. Everyone says they owe their lives to you. I need that kind of leadership here." "But," I asked, looking around warily. "You have a large group, Talbot. Our resources are already stretched thin. We need medical personnel. Your daughter has stated that that would be something she would like to achieve, along with your niece. Your wife expressed that she would teach, as did your sister. These are all things that will greatly aid our development here, but it will take time until any of them are up to speed and contributing. So to pay their dues, you need me in your army. Is that where this is going?" I asked. "You and a few others from your group?" "Yes." "And if I were to say no?" "Don't let pride impede what you have traveled across the country to obtain. We have all made necessary sacrifices for the greater good." "You have no idea, Colonel, the amount of sacrifice we all have endured." "I do not doubt it. You haven't been here long enough to realize what we are trying to accomplish. Is that a fair enough statement?" I nodded. "You'll see soon enough. Come, join us. Help us get there. Maybe someday soon we will be able to just accept all people, regardless of skills or previous occupation." "Well, since I'm an officer now, does that mean I can drink at the OC? If we had one, you most assuredly would be welcome." I shook the colonel's hand. "Gunnery Sergeant Tajima has your uniform. He'll brief you on where and when you need to report for duty." "I am way too old for this shit," I muttered as I walked out of the colonel's office. Epilogue 1. Spent the next 3 months of my life going through officer boot camp. When they realized I could fight and shoot, I was promoted from a butter bar second lieutenant to a silver bar first lieutenant. In that time, Tracy picked up a history teaching gig, and Nicole was taking her first rounds of exams to become a nurse. She eventually wanted to be a doctor, but it was imperative for her to begin contributing quickly. Travis was allowed to finish his traditional schooling. We were all, in one way or another, beginning to assimilate into this new world we had struggled to place ourselves in. When I was done with my training, I was allowed to requisition personnel for my squad. I snagged Sergeant Tynes, who ended up being entirely too surly for anyone else. Sergeant Winters asked to be on my team, as did Tommy and Gary. My chosen, along with 7 other men and women, made up my squad. We were part of the 52nd Marine Corps Exploratory Brigade. My squad's basic mission was to discover and retrieve assets for the camp. This could include, but was not limited to, food, supplies, weaponry, or people. I wasn't keen on the regimentation of military life, but it was hard to deny the benefits my family was deriving. Travis was dating a girl. Nicole was starting at the hospital next week. Tracy had received 4 apples as her second grade student's favorite teacher. My sister, her baby boy, Ryan, Justin, all of them were in school and had secondary chores like tending gardens, watching preschoolers. We had a mission. We were working toward building a strong, vibrant community that could thrive after the end of the world. And we could feel it. I had hopes that my grandson would grow up in a world devoid of zombies. Another added benefit of being here was I saw less and less of Dano. She appeared to be working her own magic and setting herself up. Last I had heard, she was being added to the civilian board that dealt with, well, you get it. Maybe not the absolute power she was striving for, but certainly a stepping stone in the right direction. The average Joe here wanted to believe that the people ran the show. But Aetna was a militarily run organization from top to bottom. The board was only created as a sort of liaison. Sure, citizens had input, but at the end of the day, nothing here existed without the iron fist of the military keeping all of the monsters, human and zombie alike, outside the gates. Normally, I would not be all right with that as the status quo. But for the time being, I understood the necessity of it. I think because of this, when I did run into Dano, I felt like I always got a heavy dose of thinly veiled contempt wrapped in a heavy cloak of passive aggression. I also think she only pretended to hide it that well to irritate me even more. She just couldn't stand that in the hierarchy of things I was many rungs above her station. Honestly, I didn't give a shit. As long as she stayed away from me and mine, she could feel however she wanted. Although I knew that was a bad stance to take when dealing with Dano. It's never wise to turn one's back on a pit viper. But at the moment, I felt I had bigger things to worry about.
"Ah, Lieutenant Talbot, good to see you," Colonel Bennington said.
"You as well, sir," I told him.
"I heard your training went well. You ready for your first mission?"
"I am, sir. I never thought I'd be in a rush to leave the relative safety of camp, but now I'm beginning to get a little stir-crazy."
"Well, this ought to stretch your legs a bit. Sending your team to Idaho."
"Idaho, sir.
Missile Silo 272, as a matter of fact."
"Please tell me I'm not retrieving a nuke, sir. Sergeant Tynes will kill me."
"No, nothing like that. Somehow a group of molecular biologists found their way into the defunct silo and were able to get the communications up. We picked the signal up yesterday. You and your team will parachute within 10 clicks of the silo, report back your findings, and secure the scientists. Then we'll arrange for helo extraction."
"Sounds easy enough. Anything else I should know?"
"Well, I would imagine keep an eye out for zombies."
I laughed.
"Yes, sir."
Epilogue 2, or Talbot's Ode 1. Okay, I feel like I may have related this story before, or possibly I'm dealing with the Mandela effect. Either way, here goes, either for the first time or not. Did I ever tell you about that time I almost died? Isn't that a rich line? I mean, this entire set of journals revolves around me almost dying. Somehow, I've avoided that tenacious bastard, but eventually I'll pick the right door, and he'll be standing there, like in Let's Make a Deal. Or I could just cheat, like I'm sure they did. I used to wonder if maybe Bob from Spokane never really had a chance as he picked door number 3, like maybe all the prizes were on wheels and they just slid the pallet with the 47 cans of spicy spam to whichever door he chose, and the new car and home entertainment center to the others. So, yeah, I was playing the shell game with the Dark One. And someday he'd figure out there was actually no ball underneath because I had palmed it. Until then, he can go fuck himself. I mean, really, what other choice did I have? Let me get back to where I was going with this. I was out in Colorado, and Dennis had come up to visit from Colorado Springs. Not entirely sure why. Maybe he knew I was going to try to kill myself and wanted to prevent it, although I almost took him with me. Interest peaked yet? Not as salacious as it sounds, but much more terrifying. I know, stop telling you and let it unfold. So I'd had my Jeep for a couple of years. I'd taken her off-road more than a few times, plus I had some experience with another Jeep I owned once upon a time. I wasn't a novice, but I also wasn't a seasoned veteran. Just enough bravado, stupidity, and booze as to be dangerous. Really, though, isn't that how most craptastic things start? Plenty of cringe-worthy videos on YouTube start with the line, "Hold my beer." So we're heading out from Denver to the mountains,
to Waldorf Pass. Almost sounds like there would be a resort up there. There isn't. After about an hour and a half of normal driving and three beers, I was pacing myself. We get to the actual trailhead. The first 3 miles were fairly easy. Sure, there's a lot of tossing around and some avoidance of bigger boulders and ruts, but for the most part, it is a tree-lined route, beautiful in its own right, but for a couple of switchbacks, not overly dangerous. Of course, by now, we were officially off-road, and I wasn't terribly worried about a police cruiser pulling up behind me. Maybe a forest ranger, but we're talking the Rocky Mountains. That's a lot of terrain to cover. "Beer me," I shouted to Dennis over the music playing much too loudly. I'd had to turn it up to mask the squelching of the styrofoam cooler we'd brought with us. You know that high-pitched squeal from hell I'm talking about? Now, pretend that loose-lidded cooler was weighted with ice and beer and locked into a paint shaker, because that's what a Jeep feels like on uneven terrain. And that son of a bitch was letting us know exactly how it felt in the most disruptive and aggravating way possible. I was enjoying nature in the only way men know how, with a burgeoning buzz. It's almost like we feel that we've so tamed the beast of nature that we can flaunt our arrogance at it. We got up to the top of the first summit. Used to be an old silver mine, I believe. There are the ghosts of two structures long since succumbed to the elements. It was an incredibly beautiful day, blue skies for miles. We were looking down over an expanse of green field, replete with wildflowers and the occasional elk. And just to make it that much more picturesque, there was a deep blue stream cutting a wide ribbon straight through the middle. I brought the family up here before. The kids love the silver slag piles. They're loaded with pyrite or fool's gold. We had enough of it at our house, we could have opened our own gift shop. I mean, if people wanted to pay for that kind of thing. I wonder if you know where I'm going with this. If you've read enough of my journals, it should be fairly obvious. Beautiful day, check. Beautiful scenery, check. Drunk, pull out the rifles. Check. Had a little Marlin 22 caliber with me. We plinked at some cans and other targets because obviously beer and guns go well together. At this point in my life, one has to wonder how I had not received multiple Darwin Award mentions. Maybe I had. They just never invited me to the ceremony. We'd shot off 100 rounds or so, chewed through some jerky, and drank a few more beers when Dennis pointed to some other trails that led off from the plateau we found ourselves on. I'd looked upon those trails many times before with my kids and wife. The one to the right looked terrifying. Had to be a 45-degree angle straight up the side of the mountain. My Jeep was a beast, but I'd done nothing aftermarket to beef her up, and that particular trail looked out of my depth of range, even with beer goggles, which, even as I write this, I'm clapping myself on the back for getting that one right. If I stalled out, or maybe she didn't have enough torque, or who knows, I run over a big enough rock with enough speed it lifts my front end just enough to fuck up my center of gravity, and we're flipping end over end down the side of a mountain. Roll bars are designed to deal with that exact scenario, but just because they're there doesn't mean you want to test them out. Ever want to use a flotation device on an airplane? Fuck no, you didn't. Or a gas mask during a chemical attack. Again, no. They're designed to potentially keep you safe. But if whatever shit fest you find yourself in has gone down, who wants to have to rely on them? The other trail, to the left, we couldn't see much of. The trailhead, as it curved around the base of the mountain, was slightly steeper than the trail that brought us up, and the rocks a little more pronounced. But with the level of liquor I'd imbibed, it was more of a challenge than a dare. Not sure of the distinction, but it seems relevant. A challenge you place on yourself. It's yours to conquer. A dare comes from elsewhere, meaning your pride is at stake. Never had gone up this particular trail with the kids, first off, because it took an hour and a half to get to the mountains and then another hour and a half to get to the mine. So once you start doing the math and realize I still have to go home and, well, there is a time dilation event that happens with kids in any vehicle. All trips stretch on indeterminably. 6 regular hours in a car is somewhere near 24 with kids. Weird fucking phenomenon. But that doesn't make it any less true. Secondly, when I was sober, there was a small, rarely listened to voice in the back of my head that said it was mostly untraveled because it was a more technical trail. But I drowned out that little fucker after the 6th beer. He couldn't do much except scream under the fluid, and by that time you can't distinguish words. "Let's do it," I said, as I got back into the Jeep. Dennis grabbed a couple more beers from the cooler, and off we went. Started off easy enough, kind of like the introductory screens to a video game, learning the basics, nothing overly challenging. That changed abruptly the farther up the side of the mountain we went. The trail continually got thinner, from something a large Ford truck might be comfortable with to a trail a goat might feel a wee bit claustrophobic on. Had a steep rock mountain to my right and a sheer drop-off to my left. I'm not exaggerating when I say I was hanging half a tire off the edge. My liquid courage was rapidly vacating, and I was stuck with my white-knuckled hands at 10 and 2, doing my utmost to not look out my driver's side window. Dennis had yet to pick up on the precariousness of our situation until I navigated the first switchback, and his happy ass got to be in the hot seat. I mean, we were both screwed if I went over. But when you can actually look out your window into space like you were on an open-air biplane about to do a barrel roll, well, let me tell you, that begins to pucker the old poop shooter. For a while, he could do nothing but stare out that window. Then he was all eyes front, holding on to the fuck-me bar that is right above the glove box. It's basically there to keep you from shaking back and forth and smacking your head into the window, or as something to make you feel better when you're about to wet your pants. "You should move over," he squeaked out without looking over at me. Or maybe he did. Lord knows I wasn't going to swivel my head to see if he had. Nowhere to go, brother. Maybe back? No place to turn around. You want me to back down this thing? On second thought, "I'd get you a beer, but I'm petrified, Talbot. What makes you think I could spare a hand to grab it?" "I can appreciate that." And as if this weren't screwed up enough, want to know what happens in the mountains a lot in the afternoon? Crazy-ass storms. That's what happens. There was a range of peaks off to our right, and the sky over them had turned a steely dark tone. A wall of thick clouds releasing torrents of rain was coming our way. "What the fuck is that, Talbot?" Dennis asked. "Trouble," was all I could manage. "What do we do? What do we do?" He repeated it quickly, like maybe the answer would miraculously come to me the second time around. I did the only thing I could. I kept moving up. There had to be a way out of this, or we'd be seeing multiple wrecks down at the bottom of the chasm. Of course, we couldn't see the bottom of the chasm. We watched in fascination as the curtain of rain marched toward us. It was just starting up the side of our mountain when I finally came to a widening in the road. When I say widening, I mean a slight bulge. In the narrowest way possible, I did an 18-point turnaround, getting us headed back to sanctuary. By this time, the first fat droplets began to hit the windshield, and I prudently decided to stay put in the relative safety the bump out afforded us. The droplets became a steady rain, and then a monsoon beat down. We weren't moving, and my wipers were on fast but could not keep up. Driving was out of the question. Want to know what we could see before the buildup of water on the window made it impossible to look out? Sure you do. Our trail home was eroding. The deluge was so vicious it was taking dirt and rock with it. Maybe it was attempting to show us our own upcoming fate. "That's probably not good," I said aloud as I pointed it out. "How attached to this Jeep are you?" he asked. He wanted to walk out. I understood the sentiment. But we were pretty deep in the clutches of the Rocky Mountains, and it would be many long hours in inclement weather attempting to break loose of her hold. We held on until the rain stopped and the sun came back. The weather was acting like nothing at all had happened, but we'd witnessed her little tirade and wouldn't soon forget it. Dennis got out, and I scooted over the gear shift to exit out his side as mine was up against the mountainside. We walked down the path a little. The ground wasn't too bad, but I swear an inch or two had been shaved off of our precarious perch. "But if you want to wait behind the Jeep, that's cool. I'm going to give it a go," I said, looking at Dennis and to the next front rolling in. "Seriously, Talbot? How many choices do you think we have?" "Hypothermia doesn't sound all that bad when I'm looking at that cliff," he answered honestly. "It's going to be in the 30s tonight. Might snow. We have long-sleeve shirts on against the elements. It'll be a lot quicker this way. Really, man? That's your fucking reasoning? Our deaths will be quicker.